Hello, I'm Eamon.
I'm Conrad.
I'm Richard.
And we are...
Mega City Film Club!
The Film Club is back, and we welcome a new member to the Film Club. He's already a T-shirt-wearing member of Mega City Book Club. Are you on six now, Richard?
I think so. People start to write in to ask for other people to be on, but I'm sorry about this. I'm fluttering up the airwaves on a Sunday afternoon, but it's nice to be here.
Anyway, we welcome Richard Sheaf, the Don of British comics, who has come up with an interesting and let's be honest, a banger of a film for us to talk about. One that we may be able to link to British comics, but we'll get to that. So without further ado, Conrad, take us into
Film One, Jaws.
1975, directed by Steven Spielberg, from a script by Peter Benchley and Carl Gottlieb, starring Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss, Robert Shaw, and a pretty big shark that we will get to. I suppose, Richard, before I ask you about your first experiences, I should say why you chose this one for the Film Club.
Well, I think this was an opportunity. I mean, you've done the impossible, Eamon, as ever. We found a horror film that me and Conrad are prepared to watch. You know what I mean? We are not horror film people, but this is, you know, we have anything for the Film Club. So I thought this is my opportunity to make myself watch Jaws, see what all the hype is about, and get on the Film Club and talk about it.
Excellent. Well, you've mentioned that. So let's quickly do first experiences with Jaws. And I'm going to stick with you, Richard, as your choice. I'm right in thinking a fairly recent watch for you.
Yeah, pretty. I've seen it twice now. I watched it, I don't know, maybe about a year ago, and then maybe a couple of months ago. But honestly, I think it came out in the UK on end of December 1975, and I was born at the end of December 1975. So it's been around, you know, this is definitely its 50th anniversary. It's my 50th anniversary this year. But yeah, I just really, you know, scary films and me, it was just not a good combination. It's a real blind spot for me. So yeah, probably about a year ago was the first time I actually watched it. And I certainly haven't watched Jaws 2 or 3 or any similar large aquatic animal knockoff films that have also been made over the years. I'm a one and done guy for Jaws, I think.
Conrad, when did you first encounter this movie?
Gosh, I remember, I think when I was a kid, I watched Jaws 2 on TV, I think, because I think there's one point where he eats somebody on a banana boat or something like that. And I remember that very vividly as a kid. You know, I don't like scary movies either, but like, I don't know, for me, big monster movie or stuff like Jaws is a little different. I watched a lot of big shark movies in the past. That's a genre I enjoy, you know, so I've seen Jaws a couple times. I've seen Jaws 3, I've seen Jaws 1 and 2, I've seen Jaws 3, though I'd much rather look at Michael Caine's house, I think, which I'm told is much better, to bring in classic jokes, you know, but like, and then all the other sort of, whatever, that big shark genre of things. I've seen a bunch of those ones as well that sort of come up every once in a while when they're like, oh, let's make something like Jaws. Let's have a big shark, you know. And I think actually I say that I've seen that I'd seen Jaws a couple of times. I feel like I've seen parts of Jaws a couple of times. I think I've seen like the end. I've seen like the Jaws model eating the boat or whatever 10 or 12 times, like just sort of flipping through channels on TV or something like that, I guess. As a big fan of sort of bumbling authority figures in films generally, I've seen the mayor of in Jaws a lot, you know, for various memes and jokes and stuff. But I don't know if I'd actually ever really sat down and watched the whole thing start to finish, which for me is less about horror movies and more about like sometimes old movies can be very slow, I guess. And it's hard to kind of, especially nowadays when we've got phones and we've got all these other things to distract you and stuff, it's hard to sit down and watch some of these old, like an old school, like, you know, movie where it's sort of, you know, we're still figuring out the cinematic language of a lot of this stuff. And so what I really liked about this new remaster and this new version that was back in theaters was actually getting a chance to go into the theater and really be able to focus on just watching the movie for its whole runtime and stuff, which I think is a really valuable way to experience these things.
Excellent stuff. Yes, it is, of course, the 50th anniversary of Jaws, and there is a 4K restoration going round on big screens. Conrad, you had a chance to see it on the big screen. I did the same. Richard, did you get a chance to see the 50th anniversary version?
No. I only got a chance to watch it at home on Netflix or wherever it lives in the country usually.
Yeah, I think it is on Netflix at the moment. I'll just quickly say that I was 14 in September 1975. So I actually went to see this in the cinema with my parents in December, or probably in January 1976. Conrad, I'll say that, of course, this is released in the US in June 1975. So by the time it reached British shores, it was already a blockbuster. We all knew about Jaws, that you needed to go and see this. I realize it's the 50th anniversary, and normally we get the guest to do the plot synopsis of Jaws. Richard, I mean, in a line or two, what's it about?
Well, yeah, I think we can spoil this here, but I think we can take it as read that a lot of people have seen Jaws. I'm late to the Jaws party, other people aren't, so I... So it's about I guess like in all those Steven Spielberg sort of ways, it's small town America, and that menace. The menace is this enormous shark, and the sort of the battles, not just between the shark, but between the sort of the town's folk, and the importance of having the beaches open for the Memorial Day weekend. You know, the mayor is very keen. It's a tourist town. You've got to have the beaches open. And yet you've got this marine biologist wandering around saying, you've got to close the beaches, you know. So the first half of the film, there's that tension between what are they going to do about this shark? And then probably the second half of the movie is then actually sort of the hunt. It's the sort of the Moby Dick sort of staging and, and how well/badly that goes. And I would say, as someone coming to this very recently, the jump scares got me every time. You know, I was they got me. So
right, well, as we say, it's 50th anniversary. It is one of the most discussed films in cinematic history, I'm going to suggest. And now it's our turn, three more blokes to give their opinions. Richard, of course, you know, you are the most recent convert to the Jaws cause. What did you make of it when you finally got around to see it?
Yeah, I have to say the scares scared me. You know, the bit where they, you know, he's dived under the water and he's looking at that sort of can't remember what the name of the sort of the small time fisherman that's gone missing, and he gets the shark tooth out, and then the disembodied head, appears, and that absolutely, you know, I was just sort of sat in my lounge watching it, and I absolutely jumped, and it was just.
Ben Gardner's boat.
And then obviously, you know, I didn't know how it ended. You know, I knew some of the sort of, like Conrad, you know, you recognize some of the sort of the key images and scenes, but I didn't know how it ended. And, you know, that the boat, the orca, right at the end, you know, he's getting lower and lower and lower in the water, and he's getting higher and higher and higher up that sort of up into the crow's nest. And I'm thinking, you know, you're going to need a bigger crow's nest. And I thought, I don't know how this is going to end, but it doesn't look like it's going to end very well. And then, phew, it does just about end, in a very satisfying manner. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was fantastic.
Conrad, you of course had the opportunity to see it in LA on a big screen in this lovely restoration. What did you make of Jaws at 50?
I saw it actually at Universal Studios, where I could have gone on the studio tour and seen like the actual like recreation of the Jaws model and stuff, like, be menaced by Bruce himself down there in the water, you know. But you know, talking about it reminds me a lot of the other Steven Spielberg movie we've done for the film club in E.T., I guess, where so much of Jaws is establishing the tropes of an entire genre of films, basically. The fighting a monster and you don't, you know, that just stays mysterious for large amounts of the movie. Certainly, my favorite bits are definitely just people not believing in that they're in a monster movie, basically. That they're in this kind of situation, all that kind of like small town politicking and stuff. Really, I think that's really that's really fun, I think. And then it goes from that to this kind of like in The Hunt, it goes to this kind of series of character moments, I guess, between Schneider, Dreyfus and Shaw. You know, I mean, very much. Sorry, when I was in high school, I was in like an acting class and we had to do monologues and stuff. And this guy I know did Shaw's USS Indianapolis speech from Jaws, like, wow, for the class and stuff like that. So it's got sort of a little bit of a place in my heart as well, just to kind of have, it's interesting to kind of have these sort of slow, tense character moments along with, here's a big shark that's eating people, you know, like, I think it because it's kind of creating tropes and setting up and kind of, yeah, creating a genre almost of the summer blockbuster of the modern creature feature and stuff like that. It's able to have its cake and eat it too in terms of being this sort of scary action movie, but also, you know, having opportunities for good acting and storytelling and stuff. Like Jaws is just really, it's just a masterpiece. It's a really great film.
And I'll just quickly shout out another actor, Murray Hamilton, as the mayor of Amity Island. I know, Conrad, you're not particularly a fan of his decision-making, but you are a fan of his tailoring.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I told these guys, you know, that's why I'm here today in my podcast suit, which is just like his gray suit with all the anchors and stuff, but it's got microphones on it. You know, we're recording this podcast. It's essential for the local economy, folks. We got to get out here. Ah.
We know the production of this film was not easy or straightforward or was somewhat troubled. We know that the shark model wouldn't work consistently, and what I got from watching it this time on the big screen was a real sort of sense, as you say, Conrad, they're sort of making up some of this cinematic language, and that it's a young crew who are just doing things on the fly, and so I don't think they had a lot of takes. So even if Roy Scheider slips on the sand, they keep it in. If somebody barges into Richard Dreyfuss on the dock, it's still in the film. I got that real sort of, you know, it gives that very sort of real feeling to it, that this is a small town dealing, as you say, nobody knows they're in a monster movie.
Yeah, I didn't realise how troubled the production was that I was reading a bit about it in preparation for this. And yeah, like, I mean, it's, yeah, it sounds like, you know, that it's a massively over budget, or the idea of filming lots of stuff at sea. And I think, you know, Spielberg talks about this sort of that ignorance or arrogance of youth, thinking, well, obviously, you know, it's a water based movie, you know, we should do it out at sea and all that stuff. That, you know, it just you know, comes together brilliantly in the film. And like I say, that sort of that truth of, you know, people slipping on the sand, or, you know, bumping into each other, you know, just really keeps it together as a piece.
And, of course, you know, Bruce perhaps doesn't give always the best performance because it wasn't working half the time. But we do have the central three, Roy Scheider, Dreyfuss, Robert Shaw, on a boat, three men on a boat, some absolute powerhouses of acting. And the scenes between them, what did you make of this, Richard? Because, again, as I say, you've probably just seen the odd clip and then come to it fairly new. What did you make of the three big main actors?
Yeah, I mean, Colin's comrades mentioned it already. That sort of the USSS Indianapolis speech. I mean, I hadn't seen that before, and I was sort of thinking, you know, sure, I recognize, you know, from being in The Sting, where he plays the guy they're trying to fleece out of the money, and I'm sorry, this is sort of kooky sort of character, and I didn't get him enough, and then he does that speech, and I'm like, okay, now it all, you know, everything that you said before, you know, now I see it, now I get you, and I see where this is all coming from, and that really blew me away when he did that. That was sort of terrifying, you know, in a sort of, you know, this is a scary film, which, you know, in lots of ways doesn't feature a shark. You know, there are other scary things. You know, he was particularly powerful. I got to understand the others were more, straightforward is not the right word, but.
Yeah, you can kind of understand where they're coming from. I mean, very much like Schneider, you know, he's sort of like there's a small town cop with a family who obviously doesn't want the people he's supposed to be protecting to be eaten by a shark, you know, and there's a marine biologist who's obviously like interested in sharks, you know, and in marine wildlife and stuff like that. But sort of this sort of slightly more wacky fisherman obsessed with shark murder. Like, what's this guy? You know, that's a backstory you need to hear a little bit, you know?
Yeah. I think you're right. But yeah. And that sort of Schneider is a sort of, he's obviously been a cop in New York, and for some, I'm not, has he ever made clear why he's left New York? He's sort of come to this small town, you sort of feel he's troubled, and he's scared of the water, and, you know, he's a scared man, and it's all about, you know, that character trait of being afraid to get in the water before anything even starts, you know, and then he's so powerless to prevent these terrible things that are happening. It's just heartbreaking, really. So,
and a quick mention, of course, for John Williams's score. This is the start of a long and very successful working relationship with Spielberg. And I know we've all heard the quote that Steven Spielberg said that John Williams gave him the shark when he couldn't put the shark on screen because it wasn't working. I mean, it's just like one of the best bits of film music, isn't it?
A thousand things are based on those ominous cellos in Jaws, you know, just the idea of that. In a thousand different ways, you know, just like, I mean, obviously there's sort of, you know, there's things with like audio stings or like, you know, a song that sort of sort of associates with the character. So you can kind of play the song in different places to kind of, you know, to evoke that character in the audience's mind and stuff like that. I mean, you know, in the like, you see it as time goes by in tons of films. My favorite sort of maybe Lord of the Rings or something like that, where like all the different characters have little musical things. You put it together, it becomes the big Lord of the Rings theme or something like that, you know. But very much like it's just a shorthand for shark attacks or for, you know, characters generally. I feel like, you know, it's one of those. Sorry, not to get too heady, but one of those, it's just like a thing that everybody knows. It's part of like Western culture. Like, you sort of go up behind somebody, goes da 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 da, you know, that kind of stuff. Everyone instantly knows what you're talking about and knows sort of the threat you're making or something like that when that happens. And it really speaks to how evocative it is and just how much it, like, even if you haven't seen the movie, just it reflects on and becomes sort of, yeah, just like something that is instantly recognizable and instantly just a signature piece of filmmaking, I think.
Now, of course, we are ostensibly a comic book podcast, Richard, so we need a bit of comic book history. Tell us a little bit about Hookjaw, which obviously is our way in.
So Hookjaw is a shark character who appears in the first action in the first issue of Action Comic, which comes out on Valentine's Day, 1976. And he's a great white shark, and he has he's had an encounter with a shark hunter previously, and he has, as his name suggests, he has sort of a boat hook sticking out of his lower jaw, as if his sort of enormous great white shark teeth are not enough to get you. There is also this large hook sticking out of his mouth, which does make him distinctive and, you know, is useful because obviously, as we know from Jaws the film, it's easy to confuse your very large sharks, you know, and it turns out that that first shark they capture is just a tiger shark, and it's not the actual shark. So having a shark with a very distinctive, it's the equivalent of his dandere eyebrows or something. So you really know it's the shark.
The hooks indeed.
And in so he runs in action, and it is particularly graphic and gruesome a story. It is mainly wrong-uns that get get their arms bitten off, chewed off, fall off, but you know so that he's doing the good thing, hook jaw, but it is unbelievably violent. I'd have to say, from having looked at it, flipped through it this afternoon, sort of some of Ramon Sola's artwork, you know, there are limbs everywhere. There's one, my favorite image is, there's one bit where you can see the great sort of maw of Hookjaw's mouth, and there's a diver, and he's just sort of swimming along, and he just says, "Hope this is the one." Says,
that's the iconic image from Action, from Action One, actually, just that it's so big that he thinks his mouth is a cave that he's going to find safety in.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, I'd say the character, he grows and shrinks in size a bit. Sometimes he's about the size of a double-decker bus, and sometimes he's only the size of a small family car. But he's a fantastic character. He's up there with the great non-speaking characters. He's not quite the only bear on the CIA death list, but he's pretty close. So very 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 popular character. I mean, popular enough that he's been revived. I think Titan Comics revived him for a 5 or 6 issue series not that long ago, and then there was another series that ran. I'm going to say the Meg, but it might have been the Prog.
It was the magazine. Yeah.
It was the magazine. Yeah. So yeah, he's been in reprint collections a couple of times, and we'll see him in Rebellion's first reprint, I think, when that comes. The Action Archive that's coming out not so long away now, which is like a reprint of the first 10 issues of Action. So we can look forward to seeing that amazing Ramon Sola, goriest art in comics, available to a wider audience.
Conrad, you did a series covering Spaceman, a reaction covering Action Comic. Yeah. Is Hookjaw the goriest strip in comics?
Oh my god! Reflection? Probably. Hookjaw is wild, just in terms. Yeah, the, like you said, Richard, the very much the Hookjaw shape shifting abilities is always key. He's big enough to swallow boats whole, but he's also small enough to slip through a crack in a wall if it's necessary, just to get places and do things like that. Something I think, I don't know if the collected version has the color pages, because I think the color pages in Action really tell the tale, because there's some of them that, limbs and body parts everywhere, but some of those color pages would just be all red. You're holding stuff up,
Richard.
Some panels and pages that are just completely red from the blood of people being in the water, filling everything around them and stuff like that. I forget the main dude's name, but he's very much, they sort of take the joke of the mayor of Amity and, people having to, we got to go back in the water. We got to do business, that kind of stuff. They basically make the main dude, he's just like Cassandra from a Greek myth, constantly saying no, don't go in the water. You'll be eaten. And then people instantly being eaten constantly, because unlike Jaws, where they have the whole runtime, so they've got an hour and a half or whatever, so they can sort of they don't have to show the shark all the time. Obviously they can't because of the model and stuff, so they've got to build the tension and stuff. With Action, they've got they've got 3 pages every week, and someone's got to be eaten in every single issue, otherwise why are we doing this? And so way more than Jaws, I think Hookjaw is really just this glorious feeding frenzy of just You know, it's literally three pages. So it's like, establish the scene, establish a jerk, you know, set the jerk up for his comeuppance, then he gets eaten. It's like, someday we'll defeat this murderous shark, you know, come back next week. You know?
Fade to red.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, it's three pages and two of them are full color, or is a full color spread of just like people being, you know, destroyed by a shark, just blood everywhere. I think we were there when the main guy or you were on that episode when the main guy got killed, and it's my favorite story to tell because he gets eaten in such a way that like the jaws come down and his head kind of pops out. So basically Hookjaw bites off his body. You know, and he's just a head left, which is my favorite thing to say.
So you saw it. So obviously, Action comes out in early 1976. So it's obviously being developed, you know, by Pat Mills in sort of the autumn of 1975. So at that point, Jaws is out in the US, but not in the UK. And again, I was reading Wikipedia earlier, which tells me that Jaws sort of set the template for being that sort of big summer blockbuster. Previously,
yeah.
Summer was the dumping ground for movies, and the sort of the winter was when they, you know, all the big movies came out. And this flipped it on its head and created this template for the summer blockbuster. So you going to see it when it came out in that December 75 or January 76? So you knew about it as a thing, you know, even without the internet, the sort of the story of Jaws had filtered over enough that you knew about it, and Pat Mills was obviously impressed enough to know that it was big and that he wanted it in action.
Yeah, it was a cultural phenomenon already. Yeah. There'd been so many stories in the newspaper about it with stills from the film. And I do think the timing and the certification is interesting because, as you say, released in the UK in December 1975, film certification varies with history and country. But at the time, it was an A certificate, which was very controversial, but meant that if you were 14, you could go and see it, like I did. And technically, children as young as five could go with a parent, which I think still to this day we would discourage. But those 12-year-old target audience for Action, hugely excited about Jaws, but possibly not able to see it. And Pat Mills, as ever, I think his brilliance is taking these things from popular culture and turning it into something, a crib, as he famously says, in the comic.
Yeah.
And yeah, just tapping into that.
Yeah, well, and presumably, like, even, like, they would have heard about it before then, even, like, an industry. It seems like mid-70s British comics, like, publishing is sort of really keeping an eye on these kinds of trends, you know. I mean, famously, 2000 AD is founded off a magazine article about incoming, you know, science fiction movies and stuff like that. They have to keep an eye on what's gonna be hot in a couple months and put that out. I'd mention also that even if, you know, in 1975, it's something I forget this a lot, but like, even if you're a 12-year-old who saw Jaws in the theater in December 1975, once it's out of the theater, it's gone until it comes out on TV, which can take years, usually, you know, as I recall. If you're, you know, if you're that little kid who likes sharks eating people, then, like, you know, there's just no way to get, there's no content for that for like a long time. So Action fills that same thing that novelizations of movies used to do or something like that. Like, I like this kind of thing, but I can't get it regularly. So I've got to sort of change mediums to get more shark attack action. And that's what Action is providing. You know, it's sort of like, yeah, even if you like, I think there's definitely, yeah, so not just kids who hadn't seen Jaws, even kids who had seen Jaws and wanted more, like, this was the way to get it. You know, it's them providing that service of this sort of stuff that I think is really interesting, and really interesting niche for comics in this era, I guess, sort of before nowadays, where, like, yeah, if you like a movie, it'll be sometimes it's streaming as you're watching it in the theater. You know, you can go home and if you watch it 15 times or something like that, you know, you couldn't do that in 1975. And I think it's easy to forget that because of our current era of abundance that we find ourselves in. You know?
Richard, did the gore and kill count of Hookjaw lead to the fuss about action and its eventual withdrawal? And did that pave the way for what Conrad has called the low-calorie kills of robots and aliens in 2000 AD?
Well, famously, I suppose, it's that Carlos Esquerra cover. Is it Kids Rule OK? That really gets action. Maybe that's where it gets noticed, you know, because there's the police. Is he a policeman? Is he not a policeman? Lying on the floor, being menaced by that chain wielding youth. But yeah, if you were picking that up as a member of the legal profession and thinking what's all the fuss about, and then you look inside it and you get into some of that Ramon Sola, limbs everywhere, pages of blood everywhere, you know, that to me is much more terrifying. Than Kids Rule OK.
Yeah.
I think but then like you say, it paves the way for that for 2000 AD and that, you know, looking at, you know, you can kill things in the future and you can kill robots and you can kill aliens, that's fine. It's when you kill people, you know, that that's a real problem. So see Michael Mulcher's book for more details, I Am the Law, on, you know, the right sort of people to kill to make your comic successful rather than unsuccessful. I was expecting more of the sort of the Hookjaw, you know, I was more familiar with Hookjaw than I was with Jaw, so I was expecting more, you know, quite a lot of sharp action, but I didn't know that, you know, the terrible problems they'd had with the models and therefore why there isn't necessarily a lot of shark action and therefore how much emphasis they had to put on the yellow barrels just bobbing in the water and how terrifying a yellow barrel is bobbing in the water. If you've got John Williams' score behind you, if you put in the pages of action, not so much, you know, nobody is terrified of that in the page of action, but on cinema, oh my God, the barrels bobbing up and down, completely terrifying.
So let's turn back to the film. We are all familiar with the Grail Page game. We decided to do Grail scenes or Grail lines from Jaws, the movie. And guests go first. Richard, a favourite scene or a favourite line?
Oh, yeah. It has to be the scene where Quint, you know, is talking about the USS Indianapolis. Sorry, Conrad, you were probably going to choose that. but that just sort of... I just thought he was a crazy guy, you know, and then he does that. And I was like, you know, I just completely unlocked his character. And I just sort of, then when I watched it the second time around, because I knew where he was coming from, sort of made me look at his character completely differently and go, okay, you know, I see all this, I understand it. But the first time I was like, I don't know what's going on. So yeah, that was transformative, that scene.
Yeah. One of the most famous scenes and speeches in film history. One that Robert Shaw apparently had a go at doing drunk. And then messed it up and told Spielberg he wanted another go at it and then nailed it the second time, I'm told, when he was sober. So, yeah.
Got two method for it.
Two method, yeah. Conrad, I mean, obviously that would be, I think, everybody's possibly one of the favourite scenes in the movie. And in a way, the most terrifying scenes in the movie. What about yourself? Have you got something else to bring us
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of great scenes in Jaws. It's really good. I think the one that's really stuck with me actually since I watched it, there's a point where like the beaches are open and everybody's sort of hanging out. Like the whole town is basically on the shore there, but nobody's in the water. And the mayor goes up to one of the other like city fathers who's there with like his wife and his kids and is like, hey, like, you got to get in the water. Like, we've got to get people playing in the water and doing that for the future of the town. So get your ass in there, basically. And so you've got this scene of just like this family all like hold, they're like holding hands and they like nervously walk into the shallows like they're walking to their own execution, basically. And you imagine that like they're just going to put their foot in the water and then it's instantly going to be this like Monty Python like explosion of blood or something like that. But instead it's like, okay, but just like that, that tension and kind of knowing that we've found ourselves being forced to walk into this dangerous situation and the score's going crazy and all this stuff is a really great scene, I think. And one that has sort of like thinking about that has really stuck with me sort of since I watched the film.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Anything with the mayor in it is great.
It's my favorite. I love that guy, yeah. You know.
I will mention, obviously, Steven Spielberg famously looked at the script and thought, I can get another jump scare in here in the middle of the film. I saw it recently at the little community cinema down the road at the Maltins in Ely.
Lovely. Of course.
The reason I mention that is that the seating folds out from the sides of the walls. And so if somebody's going up and down the stairs, everything vibrates. So I was watching this in that seating, and when Ben Gardner's head pops out of the hull of his boat, the seating just like everybody jumped at the same time, like literally jumped out of our seats, jump scare, which I loved. So I thought that was fantastic. Yeah, so there we go. Any other honourable mentions for great moments from this film, Richard?
Any other? Shout outs. I enjoyed seeing, seeing Spielberg just sort of,
yeah,
come around and said, you know, you're so, you don't, he doesn't realize it, we don't realize it, but he's setting up these tropes that will just become, you know, this is what we think of all, you know, all American cinema. We'll use this somehow as a template, you know, we'll take from this well, as it were, and use it as that sort of, you know, the, you know, that small town, the you know, this could be happening anywhere. It's so, yeah, it's really, it's when you watch it and you suddenly think, I've seen this in a million movies, and it turns out this is ground zero. This is, you know, this is where it all comes from. So I really sort of enjoyed then thinking, oh, all those other films. Okay, now I see where we're coming from. This is where we're coming from, and to realize that was great.
And as you say, he invents the summer blockbuster. Basically, this becomes the big thing. And as Conrad has mentioned, a few years later, when E.T. comes along, we were primed in the UK that, you know, we already knew this was a film that you go and queue around the block to get a seat in, which I remember doing. I think I talked about that when we covered E.T. Any other honourable mentions, Conrad, apart from the mayor's jackets?
Yeah, I could talk about the City Fathers of Amity all day, honestly, because it's such a trope that then sort of gets subverted and stuff like that, I guess. I love any kind of situation where people are clearly in a monster, in a horror movie, and say they aren't, I guess. So sort of, you know, could be a boating accident, all that kind of stuff. Earlier in 2025, I watched Sinners, which is a really great horror movie about, you know, with vampires and stuff, and really shows how, you know, nowadays you have to subvert that trope, basically. So like, as soon as a vampire shows up, someone's like, oh, okay, it's vampires. Let's like, you know, let's do vampire hunting stuff, as opposed to spending a few, like half an hour being like, oh, it must be a wolf or something like that, I guess. Something I really like is just with a Richard Dreyfuss, where he's just kind of yelling at the mayor, I get, like, where he, you know, they're in front of the big welcome to Amity sign, I guess,
the, and he's just thing,
the, yeah the poster where they've drawn, someone's drawn a shark threatening like the girl on the interview. He's like, that picture is to scale, like that is an accurate representation of what's in the water eating everyone. It's all great stuff. And just like all these little, like, you know, all these character moments and stuff. So much of what Jaws could be. And I think, honestly, I think if you get to the later ones, what Jaws is basically is just a series of setups for people being eaten basically. But I think the first one does take time to build, to establish characters, to sort of have people have inner lives and sort of, yeah, be an actual movie, I guess, or sort of the actual characterizations and stuff. It's really interesting.
Great stuff. I will mention quickly, as you say, Richard Dreyfuss, This Was No Boating Accident, examining the remains, and he's doing great stuff in that scene, you know, when he says, can I have a glass of water, please? Because it's quite intense. And also, there's a slightly jarring scene, which I always find slightly surprising, which is when the salty old sea dog sort of steps out of the boating supplies shop, sort of looks at the camera and then walks off screen. I always wonder what's his story. You know, some resident of Amity who's just like there briefly and then walks off. But yeah. Well, happy 50th anniversary to one of the greatest films of all time. Thank you to Richard for picking it. Anything else you want to say about the film or the connection to Hookjaw?
No, look forward to picking up the Action Archive when that comes out soon. And yeah, like Conrad says, you know, can wallow in those pure red panels of Hookjaw craziness and Ramon Sola drawing the most violent strip you'll ever read.
And are they doing a sort of Scream archives, just like printing the entire comic minus some of the ads, presumably, in just one volume?
It's the first 10 issues.
Right.
So I think there are, is it 35, 36 issues?
36 or so,
there's about 36 pre-ban or so.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, not to plug my own stuff, definitely, but if you're getting that Action Archive, definitely Space Spinner Reaction is a perfect perfect companion listen for those comics, because it's basically the first three issues of our coverage of Action in a book. So much of Action sets the stage for 2000 AD and is just a lot of fun. I mean, in that one, besides Hookjaw, you've also got personal favorite Dredger. There's like there's sports action. There's The Running Man, which is about a dude sort of with facial reconstruction surgery on the run. There's a bunch of really great stuff in there that I would really recommend. Yeah. Just thinking about about Action and Hookjaw is really fun and really sets the tone for this sort of creature story. Yeah, for your Shackos, your Ant Wars, your things that are such a staple of then the early days of 2000 AD as well.
So Spaceman, a reaction, the perfect audio accompaniment to your reread of the Action Archive in one collective volume.
We try our best, 10,
yes, you know. The first 10 issues thereof. And also, if you're playing the Space Spinner drinking game, this episode we've had Conrad's 12-year-old Cockney comic fan.
That's
and
right.
A dredger.
Listen.
Give the people what they want.
Yeah, well, you know, speaking of tropes, I guess, you know.
Fantastic. Well, that was Jaws and Hookjaw. I mean, I think the verdict is this film's pretty good, guys, I think.
Yeah.
Three thumbs up.
Three thumbs up.
Absolutely.
Right. Tell us where people can find you and your work on the internet. Richard, guests go first.
You can find me at www.boysadventurecomics.blogspot, where I obsessively, relentlessly am covering the entire history of Western comics, it feels like, but mainly the British ones, working through all sorts of comics, boys comics from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, original art, cover galleries, merchandise, free gifts, photos from exhibitions. It's all there. 3,500 posts probably by the time this comes out. So there's, you know, if somehow you've avoided me for the last 9 and a bit years producing this stuff, then there's plenty to catch up on. Don't you worry. It's on the 2000 AD forums. It's got its own section in the off-topic zone. So, you know, jump right in. There's plenty there. So that, and what else am I doing? Still nitpicking and criticizing other people's writing in my role as consulting editor on a few publications, working on something for Steve Holland at the moment, his Air Ace companion that will come out soon. That's really interesting. Some fantastic artwork in there, sort of a lot of airplane sort of, you know, action style covers, and continue to work for the Book Palace on their illustrators magazines. I mean, magazine makes it sound like a sort of a flimsy, floppy sort of, you know, here today kind of thing. But they are, you know, they are books, you know, they're 100 page, you know, the unbelievable quality of art reproduction from heritage auctions and any other, many other places. So yeah, look out for Illustrators issue 50 coming out quite soon, and more specials in the pipeline.
Well, congratulations on 3,500 blog posts consecutive. Well done. And and not to mention, not to blow my own trumpet, but you recently posted about an exhibition catalogue that I passed your way as well, I noted, which I hadn't mentioned yet.
Yes, yeah, yeah, no, thank you very much for that. No, it's, you, again, I mean, you've sent me down a rabbit hole of collecting. not only have you forced me to try and start documenting all the exhibition and exhibition catalogues that the Cartoon Museum have done, I've now also started looking at what the British Cartoon Archive in Kent held. University of Kent in Canterbury, where you and Tony went not so long ago for your Carl Giles deep dive, I think it was. So yeah, I've started that, and it's, yeah, turning up things that I didn't know existed. So yeah, it's brilliant, rabbit hole. Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, boysadventurecomics.blogspot.com. Conrad, tell us about the good ship Space Spinner 2000 at the moment.
Space Spinner 2000, as we're recording this, we're finishing up 1995. We're going to have to take a little bit of a break after that, so sort of news forthcoming, I guess, but new episodes planned the pipeline. We're going to get to 1996, going to keep going forever, frankly. We're also going to, I'm going to try in the interim, I'm planning to sort of roll out the YouTube channel a little bit more, just because I know a lot of people get their podcast from there, basically. So I'm just trying to do some batch re-uploads and get some, like, sort of revisit some old episodes and putting them up there for folks to listen to. But, like, generally, yeah, you know, Space Spinner 2000, we talked about 2000 AD, Judge Dredd magazine. We did, yeah, relevant to here, as mentioned, sorry for plugging early, but we did a retrospective on the entire run, or the pre-ban run, I should say, of Action Comics. We did a similar thing for Star-Lord, all this kind of stuff. We just try to keep observing these British comics, having a good time with it, for sure.
Excellent stuff. So spacespinner2000.com for all of that. And you can find me at megacitybookclub.com. And if you have a film that you can link to British comics in some way, if you have a big enough boat, if you have some scars that maybe you can tell us about, then you too could join us on board the Orca in Megacity Film Club and email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, with your film suggestions. Conrad and I, we might need a bigger pod, but we'll see.
Oh, that's a good time.
Great. Thank you very much to Richard for coming into the Film Club. Seasoned book club member, but now a Film Club aficionado as well.
Fantastic. Thanks for the invite. Thanks for the ticket.
Until next time, I've been Brody.
I've been Hooper.
I'm Quint.
And we have been...
Beggar City Film Club!
Farewell and adieu, you old Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu, you ladies of Spain. For we've had orders to sail back to Boston, and never more shall we see you